Talk.
Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and this is Jake McClure. And last hour, I ended up talking about bonds and stocks and what would drive them to do the same thing at the same time. If bonds and stocks are both rising at the same time consistently for a long time, there's a problem. Because it means that people aren't looking at what they're buying. People don't tend to focus their assets across lots of areas that don't have kind of the same purpose. So keep that in mind. The caller last hour talked about the man in the cow costume being interviewed on the news and talking about bonds and stocks being going up at the same time, and that can lead to disaster. It is possible if that is the norm. If all we see is the two of them rising hand in hand, it means that we are not sensitive to the needs of our own portfolios, because you have to understand the underlying cause for people that put money in any market. They either want to buy something so that they can use it, or they want to buy something so that long term they will be paid for that thing. So that they will be paid as an owner or be paid to sell it to someone else. If you own a loan, then you're a bondholder. And a bondholder, you expect to be paid for it. If you just ask your typical person, would you buy a bond that would pay you no money? Most of the time, no. There have been some recent events in Europe that says that the bond market is in a bit of a bubble. People shouldn't be putting long-term money out there that they expect to get a return on and not get a return or paying for. So bonds are in trouble. I said last hour at the end that I would talk about some of the issues coming up. We are still very, very low on the interest rate spectrum. People who most of their lives they would never have thought that someone could get a mortgage for 3.7%. But those things are available right now. If you've got a mortgage in the 5% range, you might want to look at refinancing these days, because if you've got good credit, you could probably get a 3.7% rate. So it's not as good as when you had a 7% mortgage and it dropped to 5, or it's not as much savings as that, but it's still some pretty good savings. Just watch the closing costs, make sure it's not too high. Now, interest rates will hopefully not stay low forever, and that's me after just saying it's great you can get a mortgage at 3.7%. The reason why I say hopefully they won't stay low forever is because it prevents us from doing things. And there's this weird conundrum here. It's a little bit counterintuitive. Banks don't want to give loans right now. They're asking a lot more questions when they give the loans than they used to. They are really tight with the money. Well, the reason why they're tight with the money is because the interest rate that they're going to get paid isn't very high. If they give you a loan for $300,000 to buy a house, and they're going to get 3.7% on that loan for 30 years, that's not really good long-term for the bank, because that's barely breaking even with paying employees and so on. It's not a profitable thing. They only want to give those loans to people that they are really sure can pay it back, because with interest rates as low as they are, they can't afford defaults on their loans. So they give less loans, which slows down the building process. It slows down new purchases across the board. Less people are able to get those loans. The long-term implication is a slower expansion. If we have short-term interest rates being low, that's great. That tends to cause, historically, that's caused booms in the economy, because everybody can go and get a loan at a really low interest rate and go for it. Well, not everyone can get a loan when those interest rates are down for so long that the banks change the entire method that they have for giving out the loans. And from the other perspective, when you make a deposit at a bank, you're not going to get paid very much either. So we want interest rates that are higher than they are today. And we tend to have cycles where they go high and then low and then high and then low. And we think, okay, those cycles, they can't be that long. Well, this last cycle has been 30 years from high to low. The end of the 70s into the 80s, we had really high interest rates. This is during the Carter and the beginning of Reagan administrations, not because they did it, but because that's where it was. It's an easy way to measure. That's who was in charge back then. High interest rates have come down since then. That means that people that owned bonds during that time period have made a lot of money, because if you owned a bond that was paying a high interest rate and over the years the interest rates have dropped, people have paid much more money for those bonds with a high interest rate. Not all the time, because many times bonds get bought back by the people that got the loan, where they say, I'm going to refinance this, I'm going to issue another bond at a lower interest rate and pay off this bond. So the long-term implication of a dropping interest rate means that those bonds are worth more. People want the bonds that have the higher interest rate, and they're willing to pay more. The opposite is true when interest rates are rising. So now we're at these really low interest rates, and people are saying, Jake, you've been talking about interest rates have to come up for a long time, and they haven't, so what's the deal? Well, they have. If you look back 12 months, they've come up a bit. They're going to come up more. The Federal Reserve is raising the short-term interest rates, and they may do it again this year. They may not. Our inflation levels are pretty low. The big piece of information on the bond front right now is we've just had two hurricanes. Well, what does that have to do with bonds? Well, two hurricanes means that there's going to be a lot more money moving around. The insurance companies are issuing a lot of money to people who have been damaged. The federal flood insurance is issuing a lot of money to people who have been damaged. That means that builders are going to get hired. Where are they going to come from? Well, the prices are going to have to come up on the builders. When prices go up enough, people will go and do building. They will stop whatever else that they're doing and go and do that if they can do it at a good rate. So what that means is that there's going to be more money moving around. There's going to be more people wanting to get loans, because construction is run off of loans. Even if you've got an insurance payment, most of the time that is paid out at the end. So construction companies tend to do the work based on loans that they've acquired for themselves. As the demand for more loans goes out there, please loan me some money, it's going the opposite direction of what we've seen for a while, which is people wanting to give loans rather than get loans. So the reason why interest rates are so low is a lot more people are trying to loan their money to U.S. Treasury bonds or mortgages than there are people that are qualified to get the mortgages or need for the money. As the need for the money goes up, then the banks are able to charge more, which causes the banks to get profitable, which causes them to give more loans to people. And I realize that you can get into some real dangerous situations there. It's part of the problem that we had at the beginning of the recession is they were giving loans to people that couldn't pay them. I don't think we have any danger of that for a while. The bankers do tend to have a bit of a long memory when it comes to loans not getting paid. And we're now 10 years out from that period. We're still nursing the bruises in the financial sector. The banking sector is nursing the bruises of having that many banks fail during that time period. The mortgage companies were failing left and right, and anybody that's been in the banking industry for the last 10 years has felt it. So they're careful about who they give their loans to. The fact that a lot of people are going to be asking for loans in the near future means they're still going to be careful, but we're going to begin to get back to healthy business as usual, not the overinflated, everybody gets a loan, doesn't matter if you can pay it. There are some good systems to block that. But what that means is that interest rates, if things keep going the way they go in the economy, I see no way that interest rates can't go up. And when they go up, this is a long period of time. I can't tell you if they're going to happen today or in a year or in 3 years. When they go up, if we continue to have a vibrant economy, they will. When they do, then you're going to see the value of bonds start to drop. And we've been talking about that for a long time. This isn't a maybe scenario. Interest rates going up cause bond prices to go down. It's just the way the world works. It's like a seesaw effect. It's not something that maybe that'll happen. No, it's going to happen. Stocks, on the other hand, aren't regulated by interest rates. You can look at if interest rates are low and a lot of money's going out of stocks into bonds, but the companies are doing well, then you would say that the stock market's undervalued. And that's what's going on that I see right now. So from banking, we'll go back to the encryption side of thing again, because this is an interesting factor in what I was talking about last hour, is that over the last several years, we've seen several decades for sure, we've seen a drop in bank robberies, massive drop. Just a couple of years ago, we were down to about 3,700 bank robberies, and that was in 2014. 2016, we were just over 4,000 bank robberies for the year, all over the United States. That is an incredibly low number. It is a number that when compared with just a decade ago was in the tens of thousands. What's happened? Well, it's easier to rob banks by robbing people's personal information. So bank robbery losses are at a very near all-time high due to identification fraud, where people are getting loans for things in other people's names. So there's a good side to this equation, and that there's a lot less fingers and paper bags pointing at tellers, hopefully fingers, sometimes guns. There's a lot less of the threat of violence, but it's worse as far as the loss rate. And there's another kind of fascinating behavioral context here. When a bank got robbed, nobody liked it. It's not like people said, hey, the bank got robbed. No, it wasn't that. But there wasn't a personal feeling of being violated. That didn't exist. If you work, if you do your work, you make your deposits, you go to the bank, you make your deposit, you leave, you check your bank account statement. It didn't affect you. It wasn't there. Your name wasn't involved with the bank robbery. There was insurance to cover it. You didn't have any losses. Today, it's much more personal. You still don't have losses as long as you catch it. You catch it and you tell the bank, hey, the credit card company, hey, somebody's using my name and my number. This isn't me. And they say, all right, you have fraud protection. We're going to cancel out those losses. We'll put it back in your account. We're going to issue a new card. But there's something fascinating here. And that fascinating thing is that we feel it. When somebody uses our card and buys stuff, we had some fraud on an office card. It was caught immediately because the lady that takes care of this, who is a superhero, has it set up to send her texts and emails when charges go through. And most of these charges were construction related in and around Houston. So just be aware that there's a lot more scams out there because of the hurricanes as well. But okay, construction related, we got that card shut off. She called the company, said, deny, this, somebody's gotten this information, shut them off. So the credit card company did. But when we log into the credit card, we can see the denied charges. And there were dozens of high dollar charges. And the staff at the office were universally upset. I don't believe that somebody would do this. That was a pretty normal statement said around the office. Why would they do this? It's very personal. Even if it's a business card and you're just you're part of a business, it's not even you personally. It's a personal attack because we get to see how that money is trying to be spent. And this comes to the kind of the wrap up of the encryption and the Bitcoin and all of that. The market only fixes problems when there's a demand for the problem to be fixed. The government lags way behind that. Where we are right now in law enforcement for violations of, when you're talking about identification theft or credit card fraud, we're kind of back where we were in the mid-1800s with the Pinkertons. There's no police force that can go all over the world to find the people that are doing these crimes. There's a website that you can go to track ongoing attacks. I'm not going to say it on the air, just there's a lot of them. And a lot of the attacks are coming from Mozambique and Russia and Ukraine and Indonesia. The FBI has very little authority there. Just imagine sending two FBI agents by jet to Mozambique to find the person at a Wi-Fi club where they're doing credit card fraud. You can see the limitation. We don't have that kind of budget. We don't have the budget to go after in the government side, to go after those people. So the banks hire private companies. The FBI is a fantastic organization, but they don't have the manpower to go to the physical location where all the fraud's going on. They don't have the authority if they had the manpower. It's very much like trying to catch Billy the Kid in the mid-1800s because the state authorities have to stop at the state line, and there was no federal group yet. The federal marshals came out of it, and eventually, in the 1920s, we got the FBI because it was really silly that the police couldn't follow people across state borders. One of the interesting factors of free trade agreements, is we get that authority. We get the ability to go to nations that have that agreement with us or inform those nations' police forces of the fraud as it's going on, where it is, so that they can send their people to go and get it. And that's one of the reasons why free trade agreements are so thick, because they deal with extradition laws for fraud and intellectual property theft, patent violations. It's important stuff. I mean, if we don't stop the people in Ukraine and Mozambique and Russia and Indonesia and Nigeria from stealing our credit card dollars, they make money doing this. We got to stop them at some point. You know, right now we change the number on the credit card. The account's different. What's next? They're just going to go to the next number. And we've got a call coming in on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, to change gears here, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about what Trump can do to prevent the next crash, and it talked about, I guess he's the first president that has a chance to replace five of the central bank governors.
Yeah.
The article mentions that Fed's got a dual mandate, keep unemployment low and consumer prices low. And this article said they want to pile on a third demand, maintain financial stability, and stabilize prices for homes and stocks. I mean, does the Fed have the power to do all three of those at the same time? I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks. I appreciate the call. The Federal Reserve's mandate started with protecting the value of the currency. It isn't necessarily keep inflation low, although that's one of the goals. It's protecting the value of the currency, which means low inflation. We don't want deflation. We don't want high inflation. The Federal Reserve Act came into it and said, you got to look at this, check on it, make sure that we're doing it right. After the recession, the Federal Reserve was mandated with another role, keeping unemployment low. They weren't given a whole lot of tools to do that. The Federal Reserve can't go out and hire people. The Federal Reserve is a conglomeration of banks, lots and lots of banks in the Federal Reserve system that are regulated by the Federal Reserve. It's in effect a self-regulatory organization, who have a mandate from Congress and some degree of answerability to the executive branch, in that the executive branch, the president, appoints the board of governors. There are a series of members that are appointed by the president. There are also on the board representations of the major districts of the Federal Reserve. So the heads of the different big banking units come into that group as well. Donald Trump has the ability of putting in five members there. We just had a Fed board member resign. He's going to be retiring later in the year. Janet Yellen's going to come up to the end of hers. We've got a couple of empty spots that were not able to be filled during the Obama administration. He had begun the appointment process, but the Senate said, we're going to wait for the next president. They have not been able to be filled during this administration, the Trump administration, because the Democrats are saying the same things that the Republicans did at the end of the Obama administration of, nope, we're going to block it if it comes up. So he has the ability to, and when it comes to the chairman role, I think it would be really, really a dumb idea for the Democrats to try to block the appointment, because it's a vital role. It needs to be filled. Adding on a mandate to regulate mortgage and home purchase and stocks would require, and the market would require, another act of Congress. They would have to agree on this. And there would have to be some other tools in place, because the reality is that, just like the unemployment issue, what can be done for unemployment? Well, the Federal Reserve banks still have the same ability of charging each other different interest rates, and that's what the Federal Reserve sets. They have the ability of buying and selling bonds on the open market. So if they see bonds out there, they can go and purchase them and kind of increase the value of those bonds. They've stopped doing that, but other foreign countries are doing it. They're coming here and buying bonds because we are still the safe haven. If you look at the difficulty of just the unemployment side, how do you keep unemployment low when the only tools that you have to do with loans and interest rates, bank loans to each other, interest rates on it's kind of a limited interest rate ability when buying bonds on the market or selling bonds on the market to lower or raise the interest rate out there. That doesn't cause people to hire. If you make it really easy for people to get a loan, they might hire. But that's the limitation that they have. When it comes to the stock market, and people have been debating this for a while, most people don't understand the tools that the Federal Reserve have. They have very limited ability to affect the unemployment rate. They have a very limited ability to affect the stock market. Now, they already have a mandate to prevent over-volatility in the stock market, and that, again, came from the post-recession acts that aren't necessarily the best ones in the world, but Dodd-Frank is a big part of that. And the extra mandate is a limited mandate. They're being held responsible for doing something that's very, very hard to do with the tools that they have. They do have a bit of a mandate to lower volatility in the market. If they're expected to do that with the mortgage market and the stock market, it isn't just an executive decision. It isn't just appointing people to do it, because they don't have the tools, nor do they have the existing mandate. Congress has to act. Whether or not they act on it is kind of up in the air. They've done some things this last week, unilateral things that across the board, both sides of the aisle, at the House level, they passed a bill giving restrictions, a clear federal restriction on and rules, guidelines on self-driving cars. And that was passed unanimously at the House, which you hear a unanimous thing. You're going to wait. Are you talking about the same House of Representatives that I am? Yes, they had a unanimous vote on that. It passed. Now states have rules that they can't get more restrictive than when dealing with interstate highway type issues for self-driving cars. And another one is the civil forfeiture law. During the Obama administration, not that it was an Obama movement, he's the one that signed the order, but it was mostly led by the libertarian faction of the Republican Party, saying that the police have the authority to seize assets if they pull you over for this is something that's been there since the 1980s. If they pulled you over for speeding, you have $10,000 in cash in your car, and they suspect you got it from a crime. They don't have to have probable cause. They just have to have a suspicion, and they can seize those assets, and then you have to come back and prove that it wasn't a crime that got you the money. And in many cases, it was delayed for years and years and years. The idea behind the law is a good one, in that if you're arresting somebody and they have a kilo of cocaine in the trunk right next to $100,000, yeah, you seize the money too. But if the level of suspicion is the police officer had to be suspicious, and then they could seize it. And what's happened with that is that many, many sheriff's departments have used that as part of their budget, because budgets have been cut in other areas and this money's there. And civil asset forfeiture has a rule. It's in place. If they suspect it, it gives them the power to say, this is good, I will take this and use it on our budget. Well, when people have come back and sued and said, hey, we're proving this was not crime oriented, it's taken years to get the money back, because in many cases the money's already been spent. And then they've got to dig into other parts of their budget to get it. What does this have to do with the Federal Reserve? It's possible, maybe, for Congress to do an act at this point to adjust the Federal Reserve. I don't think it's very likely. I think it's extremely unlikely that the current environment in Washington is going to allow the Congress of the United States to pass a law affecting more mandates on the Federal Reserve. There's just too many opposing factors to each other, not to the concept of it. The concept makes sense, and it's a bipartisan concept, but there's too much polarity in the system right now. So the president does have the ability to appoint 5 members to the Federal Reserve Board, which is more than any president in many decades has had the ability to do. And that is going to set a long-term outlook for the economy, for at least interest rates and inflation, deflation protection, possibly for unemployment benefits as well. So it's one of those things that we're watching this. The president has not been very clear on who who they're vetting to go there. He's being very vague. He likes the surprises. He likes to pop up with a surprise. And unfortunately, that's the last thing you want with a Federal Reserve Board. Surprises are the thing that they're trying to avoid at all costs on the Federal Reserve Board, because one of the mandates being lower volatility in the market. Surprise decisions, even if they're good, if the market hasn't had the ability to price it in to what they're willing to pay or be paid, it causes a little panic every time. And that's one of those areas that people don't recognize. The Federal Reserve is a lot more transparent than it was even a decade ago. They post the minutes to all their meetings, sometimes by accident in advance. But they post the minutes, and we can see what they're talking about. We can read clearly what they expect to do in the future. There's snippets of public statements that go out, and that's all to prevent volatility in the market. So there is an ability right now. This president is dynamic. That's a good word. His decision making is very often quick and final. And with the Federal Reserve, it's a very deliberative group that is very carefully measuring things. To have a deliberative final statement in the middle of it can cause some volatility. So I guess there's a lot more to talk about there, but I'm afraid I'm going to bore everybody to death talking about the Federal Reserve for too long. I've got some commercials to play, and I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you'd like to join us in here or join me in here, the number to call is 254-773-1400. I'll be back on the other side of these commercials. And I'm back. More of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call in here is 254-773-1400. I have another conversation topic here, and that is flood insurance. This is, why are you talking about this now with hurricanes? Flood insurance is a big topic, and we've talked about this on the air multiple times in the last several years. Important information here. This is an area where if you're building or are buying a house and it's in the floodplain, then there's some requirements for if you're going to get a mortgage to get federal flood insurance. What is federal flood insurance? Federal flood insurance is just about the only insurance program that will offer you insurance when you're in a floodplain. It's socialist. Insurance as a whole has a socialist with risk attached to it. But in this case, it is purely socialist because it's not intended to make a profit to the government. The federal flood insurance was to meet a problem before we had engineers saying where are likely floods to be. A lot of houses got built. Well, now that we've had flood maps out for a long time, people are still building in the floodplain. And there's a real serious problem with that, in that if you build in the floodplain, you're likely to have a flood. If you have a flood, you're likely to have a lot of loss. If you can get insurance that's not based on the risk of the flood from the federal flood insurance company, then what are they doing? Why don't they just pay you before the flood? I mean, it's going to happen. Why are we allowing the federal insurance to be purchased repeatedly? And one house, which was a headline in the Wall Street Journal, one house had 22 floods, 22 claims from the federal insurance program on that. And this time around, and there's a voluntary thing, let us buy it from you after every flood for the last 5 or 6 years. They've been asking, hey, would you mind if we bought the property from you? We'll pay you for the house, and then we'll buy the property from you. And the person that was living in the house said no, all the way up till now. Now the person says, okay, I don't want to go through this again. You can buy the house from me. This, to me, seems like a clear case for eminent domain. The public good is being violated. The fact is that insurance comes from your tax money. It's not like a normal insurance pool where everybody there's good risks and bad risks all mixed together. That insurance program is only for bad risks, and they don't charge enough to make it profitable. If the federal government would charge enough, then people would say, I don't want to get that. And the mortgage companies say, well, if you don't get it, you can't build or you can't buy there. That would be a market move to if it were doing a market-based, we've got to be profitable in this insurance program. It's not what they're doing. It was designed as a we got to protect you from yourself mentality, very socialist in nature. It's helped a lot of people. But it's kind of like if you decide that you're going to build a house in a tree, you should know that at some point the tree is not going to be around. And the house might go with it. It will go with it if it's in the tree. There's no federal program to go out and say federal treehouse insurance because it's a known loss and there's not enough people doing it. The only reason why people are still building in floodplains is because they're getting a free pass. It's not free. You got to pay for it. I know people that live in the floodplain and they go, well, I like my land. I don't know why it is that people expect to be paid by the government, by the taxpayers, to do something that they know is going to be damaging to themselves. I believe that when people do seriously self-destructive things with their health, I don't think the government should be the ones to tally up the money to fix it. Long term, we don't have a whole lot of answer to that because people are going to continue to smoke. People are going to continue to do silly things with their health. At least with the mortgage on floodplain issues, let's just look at that a little bit different going forward, because a lot of the flood relief, the dollar money that's coming in the most recent bill from Congress that was signed by the president, it's coming out for Harvey, a lot of that money is going to people who have been damaged already, who just keep rebuilding with government money in the floodplain. And it's better than it was. Please, you don't get me wrong there. It was just 10 years ago. It was a lot worse. A lot more houses were covered in the federal floodplain. That, to me, though, that I don't know. I'm kind of flabbergasted by the whole concept of a government program to pay you for a known loss that's going to happen that you're volunteering for. I think there's a real problem there. Now, if you already have the home and you bought it because the government said they would pay you in the event of a flood, I think that it would be horrible for the government to say, no, we're not going to do that. We're not going to pay you if you have it because it's not a good business decision, because you wouldn't have built there if the government hadn't said it. But I don't think they should allow new building. I don't believe that they should allow rebuilding of completely demolished houses in these circumstances, because it's going to happen again. If you're in the floodplain, it's called the floodplain for a reason. We're going to have floods there. And if you build there new houses, then you should build in a way that's not going to get flooded. And that's kind of the issue. Having had a house that was built in the floodplain, we spent a lot of extra money to get the foundation to go very deep and to prop it way up above the flood level. But it was expensive. It cost more money to do that with the house. When the flood came, and it did, we didn't have damages. But the federal government is allowing people to build down on the ground in the floodplain. That's a problem. I think it's a problem that needs some attention. The fact that we have to issue on an emergency basis money to the insurance program because it's already not profitable, and we haven't raised the debt ceiling lately, so the new tax money that was going to help it, even though it wasn't profitable, hasn't been there. Then we have Harvey, and it's suddenly an emergency. We got to get money into this program that we know we're going to be spending money on. There's a problem there, more than a little bit of a problem. Let me go on to the next subject. I would love to have somebody call in, by the way. This is me talking by myself for 2 hours, and while I enjoy the subject, I really do enjoy the subject. Usually I have old Baldy across from me adding his quips and his commentary that I can quip at. So I'm going to jump back to the Federal Reserve for just a moment. Fisher, who's a governor of the Federal Reserve, is the one that's just decided to step down. I wouldn't be surprised if that's over health issues. And I have a call coming in. So caller on 773-1400, go ahead. You're on the Personal Wealth Coach.
Yes, sir. Again, Wall Street Journal had an article that said a lot of the mutual fund, the big mutual funds are not buying as much U.S. stocks. They're going into foreign stocks. And if the United States is the, you know, hitting on all cylinders as far as the economy goes, how come people are going lean on U.S. stocks and going more international?
All right. Appreciate that. Thanks for the rescue call. Emerging markets are doing very well right now, and that's a present tense. What they'll do in the future, they have risks that are higher than other nations. America is firing on all cylinders, and we've got a growth rate that's somewhere between 2 and 3%. And that's something that we've had for quite a few years now, while the rest of the world is trying to crawl back up out of the recession. Well, now we've got the major developed countries on the planet are having growth in their economy. What that does, if you're a stock investor, it doesn't matter if it's a mutual fund manager or somebody that's doing it on their own, what that does is you're used to seeing moderate growth in the United States. Now you're seeing moderate growth in Europe and the developed world. That moderate growth is creating a new demand on the emerging technologies. Where do we find the ability to make new phones, new screens, new computers at a rate that isn't going to cost us more because people want to buy it? So we go to countries that have never done it before, that we can pay a very low amount of money for those products. The only reason why those countries get money from the developed world is because the demand and growth that already exists in the developed world. So this is something I talked about this a couple of years ago, that the emerging markets tend to recover after the rest of the developed world is growing and growing at a reasonable rate, because the demand goes up for the products of those developed countries. There are a lot of mutual fund companies and investors that are looking overseas all of a sudden, and there's probably some good growth potential there. I think it's a important factor in most portfolios to have some emerging markets in there, not just blindly, but with some thought toward it. The idea there is that emerging markets are the riskiest of assets that we track. Emerging markets, they don't just have the earnings issues of other companies. Emerging market, and I've got a call coming in. I'm going to put this on hold for a moment and hit the call. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. And I've always wondered about something. You know, not that I have that much money, but you never know. Maybe I might get lucky and have a lot of money. But if I had like about, let's say, $100 million and I wanted to hire somebody, you know, that does the type of work that you do,
mm-hmm.
When you hire somebody like this and you have that much money, you know, how can you, you know, now I don't want you to get me wrong that I'm implying anything about you. This is just my curiosity or my question. How do you trust somebody to handle your money and invest your money if you have that much money? Because $100,000, $200,000, somebody rip you off of that, you wouldn't even have a clue. You wouldn't even see it gone. So I'm just trying to figure out how that works, you know, because if you hire somebody, you have to hire somebody to hire to watch them, and then somebody to hire to watch them. That how does that work, sir? Because I'm just curious, you know, these people that have so much money, how do they protect their money from somebody that might be trying to falsely portray them to do right by them? And you have a good day. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thank you for the call. I appreciate that. Let me wrap up the emerging market side. The reason why people are in the United States are investing in emerging markets is because the potential for growth there. the gross domestic product in those countries is much higher when they do have growth. So they're willing to take some extra risk. The danger is getting in it without recognizing the risk. So that's we're firing on all cylinders, but they have a lot more growth potential than we do, because when we're talking about growth, we're talking about transition from one developed technology to the next, and we're talking about in the emerging markets transition from basically standing in a field to building something in a manufacturing facility, and the potential for profit is much higher there. Okay, so the trust issue from that last caller, if somebody has a lot of money or a little money, it doesn't really matter, but with a lot of money, it's harder. Now, I'm going to give an example of some cases where there were problems. Willie Nelson had a very trusted tax preparer that was managing all of his stuff and not doing a good job and taking some of it for himself and not paying the IRS. And we got some beautiful music out of it, and that the IRS tapes were recorded to pay back his debts to the IRS and to put him in a situation where he is transparent to himself. So what do you do if somebody has $100 million? Well, I know this is a sad subject, but I have to say it. Most people do not get $100 million overnight. Most people have developed the team that they're going to be working with for that much money over a period of decades. And Willie Nelson did, which wasn't an excuse. He was not at all paying attention to his finances during that time period. He would sign things that they put in front of him. He didn't try to understand it. He didn't educate himself. He was doing his job. He wanted them to do their job. There are things that you can do, very reasonable things. There's having an attorney, having a law firm that works for you, that works with the people on the investment side, and a separate group that does the auditing and the tax side. That way, they're all looking at each other at the same time that they're looking at you. And you can turn to one and ask them about the others. On a smaller level, below the $100 million, you know, we specialize in portfolios of $1 million plus. And in some cases, we're talking tens of millions of dollars. In those cases, what we like to do, and often we're the ones that set this up, which is just there's not a lot of education out here on this. We like to work with the attorneys that are already working with that client. We like to work with the tax preparers that are already working with that client and have scheduled meetings where we discuss strategies and create reports that are transparent to all three of those parties to then present to the client, so that the client can have some degree of trust in people that are supposed to be trustworthy. On top of that, making sure that people have credentials, attorneys that actually have passed the bar would be nice. Fiduciary investment advisors, whether they're in cases of clients that have 100 plus million, they're at a realm where starting what's called a family office starts to make sense. And that basically they have an advisor that only works for them, doesn't work for anybody else. That's called a family office. And so there's a lot of checks and balances that you can put in place at a much lower asset level as well as at the higher asset level. You develop a team, you vet the team, and then you have the team work together and have them look at each other. And it isn't like you have to verify that they're not stealing from you, but they would see it if it happened. They need to look at it in detail and earn the pay that they're being paid. And I'm about out of time for this week. I appreciate the calls. Appreciate the interest. I've had a good time talking to you. Probably going to have a rerun next week, and then we'll be back just the two of us the following week. If you would like to contact us off the air, we do give fiduciary investment advice customized to each client. There's voicemail waiting during the weekend and real life people during the week at 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. That's the personal wealth coach. You can email me directly, jake@tpwc.com. That's thepersonalwealthcoach.com. You can email Jeff at jeff@tpwc.com or check out the website. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood, the best talk in America. News Radio 1400 KTEM.